From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford University, with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Hello, Denise.
Hi, Dan. How's it going?
It's good. I'm going to try and convince you that neuroscience is useful and interesting.
Okay, I don't even know what you mean exactly by neuroscience, so...
Right. So, study of the brain.
Okay.
This is a big development that 60 years ago, you couldn't actually see the brain in action. You know, you had to wait till somebody died, and then you'd cut up their brain. Now, we have all these ways of recording what the brain's doing, and so we can see how it operates. And this is a big breakthrough.
Okay.
So here's the story. We've known for a long time that when people type, they're learning to type, and then you measure how good they are, and then they sleep, and you measure how good they are then, and they're better after they sleep.
So, wait. After you practice typing.
That's right. You're learning how to do the or something like
okay.
that.
Okay.
And they measure how well you can do this, how many times in a minute or something.
Okay.
And then you go to sleep. And then they measure you again in the morning, and it turns out you're faster than you were when you stopped.
Because you're not tired.
Right. So they've checked that. It's not it's not because you're not tired. It's actually the sleep itself. And so this is kind of a mystery. How does this work? That somehow during sleep, you actually seem to get better. So one of the things that the brain science discovered was that you have these waves when you're sleeping. There's these oscillations, and the brain sort of quiets down. And what these oscillations are doing is they're sort of moving the day's memories from the middle of the brain out to the surface. They're sort of transporting them out. So this is sort of interesting. So now we know what's going on. It's helping to consolidate the activity and set it out in its right place. So now you know this. So what? Right? So what?
Oh my God. I mean, it's huge, I think.
So sleep's important.
Yes.
But does knowing it's the waves buy you anything? And the answer is yes. So somebody ran a study where they could measure sort of what is the oscillation of your waves up and down. And then they set a metronome to that same beat. So you're sleeping, and this metronome is going at the same beat as your oscillations. And it actually improved your typing the next day.
Wait, so I'm sleeping, and we already knew that sleeping alone improves the typing.
Right.
But they want to make me an even better typist.
And they want your sleep to be even more productive.
Okay, so they're making noise in the background while I'm sleeping, basically.
Yes, but to the rhythm of your own brain's oscillations. So it's going tick. Tick, which causes your oscillations to have better form because they follow that ticking.
Oh my! The whole thing is freaking me out.
No.
First of all, I don't think I'm going to sleep very well with these people making noises in the background.
It's a metronome. It's not like an area of macaw monkeys screaming and howling.
That's good. No, I think it's really cool. I think this is awesome that they could find this out.
Yeah. So it's really surprising. Right. And so people sometimes look at neuroscience to tell them things that are obvious. And it comes up with all these interesting surprises and different ways of getting after it.
I mean, I think that's hugely surprising. I would not think of sleep as a time, for making learning better. I think that's really counterintuitive.
Yeah. Well, so a lot of people sort of think if you play Mozart while you're sleeping or you under your pillow, you put a foreign language. No, you're not going to learn that way. You don't learn during sleep. What happens during sleep is what you learned earlier gets consolidated and easier to work with in your brain.
Okay, so all the kids who used to put the cheat sheets underneath their pillows the night before the test, I think you've just ruined it for them.
Boy, was that a Hail Mary hopefulness.
And it does nothing. It basically does nothing is what you just said.
Yeah, that's sort of like anti-aging cream. So I'd like to introduce our guest today. It's Professor Bruce McCandless. He's a professor of educational neuroscience at the Stanford Graduate School of Education. Hello, Bruce.
Hey, Dan.
So let me start out so you can kind of clarify what's new. Mm-hmm. So back in the day, there was this field called phrenology. Mm-hmm. And what you would do is you would feel the bumps on people's heads and the shapes of their skull. And from that, you would make some predictions about what their personality traits were like. Mm-hmm. So that seemed kind of stupid to me. Isn't neuroscience just the same thing? I'm just measuring like how big parts of your brain are and then making predictions about what kind of person you're like?
I think neuroscience is almost exactly like that. We're trying to take measurements and we're trying to explain really, really complex human behaviors by using really, really simple metrics, and the simpler the better. So we're trying to like relate these two vastly different things. Things you can measure about a person physically and things you can explain about their mental and intellectual life. And so we embrace that same folly that the phrenologist did. But I think the methods are getting better and the ways in which we're approaching it are getting much better.
Wait a minute. Are you saying that a bigger sized brain makes a difference? You're not just measuring size.
Right. No, we can measure lots and lots and lots of things. The things that we can measure seem to expand every couple of years as the technologies grow, as our infrastructure grows, as the research questions grow. And we can put that question about size on the table and we can examine it and we can lay it to rest and move beyond these questions that may have gotten history hung up for a little while.
Cool.
So you can measure when you think certain areas of your brain are going to be ignited for that particular task. And after those cells do their work, they need blood. And so you can measure the blood coming into those cells to replenish them. And that helps you figure out what part of the brain is helping you do what kind of task.
That's very cool.
And you could explore new things. Like Dan laid out an empirical claim that putting some kind of language device under your pillow while you sleep is going to do nothing for learning. And you can examine that question. You can say, is that true? Should we lay this to rest? Is that a myth? Or is there some exciting potential there? There was actually a study that came out of Finland recently that eavesdropped on the brainwaves of babies as they slept. And they played them sounds in their native language over the course of the night, and then measured the next day and the next day and the next day how their brains responded to these sounds that they only heard in their sleep. And they found that their brain waves were changing. Their brain's response to sleep speech was changing as a result of speech that they heard while they were asleep.
Wow, I take it back.
And so it just – there may be a point in life where babies spend a whole lot of time sleeping, but they have a whole lot of language learning to do. And the brain may not necessarily shut off all of its learning circuitry at every stage in sleep. So this, provides some really interesting things to explore. Note, when you're asleep, there's not a whole lot of exciting behavior going on, but that doesn't stop science from what we can observe by using neuroscience metrics to go beyond behavior.
So I was wrong. Put the math sheet under the pillow.
It may work. You have to be wired up for something, right? It's still not going to work.
No, I don't think their measurement of the babies was making the babies learn better.
No, it was the sounds going into their brain.
But I don't think it was being pumped into their brain. I think it was just like a recording.
I know, but the math sheet is a piece of paper, Dan. That is not going to do anything.
You guys are getting silly.
Okay, we're being silly. So I have a question. It's going to, without getting too technical, I know you use MRIs, right?
Mm-hmm.
MRI.
Yeah.
So MRI is a machine like I have a hurt leg. Mm-hmm. I go into the MRI. It's like this white little tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
You hear this boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
And they can see into my leg. Are you using the same technology to look into brains?
Yeah. The R in MRI stands for resonance. So there's a resonant frequency that you can excite with the MRI to really look finely at bone tissue. But you can also tune the magnet for the resonant frequency of blood that has lots of oxygen in it versus blood that has very little oxygen in it, which means that you can take movies of how the brain is consuming oxygen in every little part of the brain, and you can look at brain activity.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we are speaking with Bruce McCandless today about looking into people's brains using MRIs and other technology to study neuroscience.
So, Bruce, I'd like you to give an example, and I think I'd like it to be from your study of how people come to learn to read. Kind of where the explanation that comes out of the brain base is kind of surprising about how the visual system suddenly has to get hooked up.
So we have been approaching the big changes that occur as children go from being kindergartners and just exploring and learning about reading to being third graders and being pretty fluent at reading. And this is a pretty remarkable cognitive feat if you think about it. But we've been approaching it from a brain science perspective. And what's remarkable about reading is that it really requires this well-articulated visual system to interact in a brand new way with the brain's language system. And we can start to see how those two systems really come together in a brand new way, supported by educational activities like what we do in schools and how we're exposed to practice and how our teacher might even help us think about language differently and map the sounds of language into the little squiggles that we see in print. So we can basically see the brain changing and reorganizing as a result of the educational experiences that kids have.
So can I ask you a question? So
sure.
When I was little, I loved the book Hop on Pop. I mean, I loved it. I read it a million times, right? Or they read it to me. And
My kids love that book.
Okay, it's a great book, right? And everyone thought that I was this young genius because I could read so early. But what really was happening is I just memorized Hop on Pop. If you gave me a different book, I couldn't read it. But
right,
I memorized
right.
and I knew what was happening. So when you're using that MRI, can you tell the difference between someone like me who's just sort of memorizing it and saying it, but not really reading, versus someone who's really reading?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we can.
That's so cool. Okay. How do you know?
So the brain uses very different connections when it's trying to break the sounds of a word down into parts and map those to letters, then the circuitry we use to look at an entire word and just sort of memorize that funny thing with the golden arches is McDonald's, and you're not really reading it. You're kind of just recognizing it and memorizing it. And we can actually take advantage of that to study how kids are learning to read and how kids differ in their approach to reading, and even how a teacher's influence might change the brain circuits that are being formed as kids are learning to read.
Can you say more about that? What would a teacher's influence look like?
So we did some experiments in the laboratory, actually, where we taught people to read a brand new writing system that they'd never seen before because we made it up. And we just examined how the brain activity differs over the course of learning. If you have a teacher that's really focusing you on the sounds within words and mapping them to letters versus just trying to recognize all the words that you're learning to memorize.
So in one case, the teacher is treating everything like a sight word.
Yeah.
This, that, but right. not sort of the attack skills for breaking it down like the, is.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we found after the course of learning was completed and kids just got a test where they all just saw these words and had to make quick decisions about them, if you had a teacher that was focusing you on the letters and the sounds, like a good kind of remedial instructor might do with a kid who's struggling with reading, we found that early, right at the time when the brain was turning that visual signal into a word that they recognized, like right about 180 milliseconds. So right in the – you're blinking your eyes a lot. Right, but I'm thinking
right
about the time it takes to blink your eyes,
yeah.
which is like 200 milliseconds. Your brain converts a visual word into a thought faster than that. And when we used an advanced brain imaging technology to look at what's going on in the brain during that blink of an eye when you turn the word into a thought, if you were in this sort of phonics instruction, there was this left hemisphere activity over the back of the head when you saw these symbols. And if you were in this memorize these word associations conditions, there was more of a bilateral, even right-sided activity during that sort of blink of an eye transition. And that's part of the power of the brain science. Instead of just looking and seeing like, okay, everybody got a 75% on this test, we got insight into how is the brain doing its job at this really fast level? Because the brain has to do all of this work in the blink of an eye for you to become a skilled reader, and now we can eavesdrop right into that process.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we are speaking with our guest Bruce McCandless today about learning how to read, about how MRI machines and other ways of measuring can tell the difference between someone just memorizing it versus actually doing the reading.
So let's stick with reading. And talk about dyslexia. So my understanding is dyslexia is really just the bottom 5% of readers. And that's sort of how it was defined.
Okay, wait. You're saying it's not an actual learning difference or disability?
Bruce, this is the opening to you.
This is controversial, people.
Well, in a sense, you can say there's this descriptive way in which we describe people that are having learning difficulties, learning disabilities. So you put everybody on a line and then say, okay, everybody who's in the bottom fifth percentile, we're going to say that you have some sort of learning disability, learning difference, dyslexia. We can put a descriptor on it. But the challenge is explaining why are those people down there? And why are they staying down there year after year after year? And why are they still down there when they're entering college and they've had all of these amazing experiences? What is that force that explains that rank order? And this is where the science of learning is using terms like dyslexia to try to say that there are some powerful explanatory forces that can help us explain why people are down on that tail and stay down on that tail versus just randomly bouncing around from year to year to year.
And it turns out there's a lot of reasons people are in the tail. Isn't this right?
Yes,
dyslexia is not a diagnosis of a specific way your brain is operating, that there's a whole bunch of different challenges that people might confront that make them dyslexic.
Right. If you think about – one way of thinking about reading development is that maybe 20 different things have to go right for, on the path to becoming a skilled reader. And there may be multiple challenges along the way that wind up explaining why you might not have made it to skilled readinghood. One of those, some of those might be kind of environmental and social. You didn't really get an environment that supported enough hours to train the brain to reorganize in this way. Others may be, and this may be the dominant explanation for most cases, may really lie in the domain of language. People who have persistent difficulties, lifelong persistent difficulties with learning to read, often have differences in the way they hear language and their ability to think about the structure within a spoken word. The brain circuits that allow you to do that may be quite different in different individuals. And that brain difference may help explain and provide some cues as to how to help the developmental understanding of reading. So we might someday have a president who can't pronounce the difference between nuclear and nuclear because perhaps the circuitry in the brain that allows them to take those syllables and break them apart into units that the mind can reflect on and the mouth can act on are operating slightly differently in that individual. We can now understand those brain differences all the way down to birth. I just came back from a trip in Finland, and there's some amazing research happening there where they take babies who are born to families that have a history of dyslexia, and they look at brainwaves of the babies, and they can determine which babies are going to, when they become eighth graders, have dyslexia, all the way back based on the way their baby's brain responds to simple speech sounds like ata versus at-a. That little gap in Finnish is really important. The brains process that differently if you're a baby born to dyslexic family who's going to, in the future, become dyslexic.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we will have more with Dr. Bruce McCandless talking about dyslexia and neuroscience next on SiriusXM Insight 121.
Students focus on what they were told, not paying attention to the situation.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
So they're not going to see anything new because they're so busy trying to copy what you told them.
From the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Dr. Bruce McCandless from the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford about neuroscience and dyslexia.
So I'd like to pick up where we left off, which was this idea that you can look at a combination of genetics and early brain behavior. So the genetics meaning it's a family with dyslexia. It's been inherited. Does the neuroscience run the risk of us viewing brain as fate? So here's an example. There was a teacher that I worked with, and there's this one child, and she said, oh, this child, I can't help that child. Their brain's messed up. And so this was a kind of a bad attitude, right? And I do worry that sometimes people will think neuroscience means you're born with these abilities and some, you know, have a bigger brain or a smaller brain. And so is this the direction it's taking us or –
I would hope not. I think that the flip side story of that is that we're finding out just how dynamic the human brain is and how plastic it may be, and even how at certain levels of development in children there may be extra plasticity, which provides new resources and new ways of thinking about how we could help children, how we can help children achieve the goals that they have and their family's goals and their cultures have for the children.
So there's something that you can do. If you have a history of dyslexia in your family or you've just discovered this, it doesn't mean this is a fate that your kid's never going to read, right?
Right, yeah. So we can start to understand there may be some, you know, core attractor state that we call dyslexia, but as we start to peel away the layers and understand what those kind of vulnerabilities are, we may get new insights into why it's so difficult and what we can do about it. So, for instance, the study that I was just telling you about from Finland was a longitudinal study. When they followed these children from birth and they showed that the brain signal was informative about the path they would take, they also found for these children, across all the things that they could do on the path to learning, there was this one challenge that all the kids were sort of flattened by, and that was linking letters to their sounds. All the children who are on the path to being eighth grade dyslexics had the most profound challenge when they were about 5 years of age, when they were trying to map all the letters of the alphabet to all the sounds in their language. And the researchers took this as a great opportunity. They said, let's create a whole suite of video games designed for five-year-old children to really kind of dive into and master. And they created this suite of games that are provided freely to children in 17 countries around the world called Graphogame that tries to give them video game experiences to help them on this big hurdle task, this barrier to learning to read, for mapping letters and sounds. And they've had tremendous success with this. The game is kind of fun. It's adaptive. It learns about you and where are your weaknesses and how can we help you along in that process. And there have been recent brain studies showing that playing this game actually reorganizes the brain circuits of even typically developing children to produce something that looks like what we see in an expert reader.
So this is a particular kind of game. I don't want parents to go out and say, oh, my kid has dyslexia. Let's just let him play video games all day long, right? These have to be targeted learning experiences for your children. I think that I just want to make sure that, that that's an important point for folks.
And I think that's an especially important point that we pair the new research together with these new learning opportunities. So we explore the space and we learn what's effective. And we don't jump to fast conclusions like, oh, video games are harmful or video games are helpful. But we explore, you know, children are interacting with technology in all these new ways. What are ways in which we can, you know, really see the benefits? And what are some of the harms that are infusion of technology into all of the cycles of our life are maybe having on children?
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we're speaking with Dr. Bruce McCandless about brain science. Brain-based education is sort of the hot term these days. In fact, I think if you ask every school, they'll say, oh, yeah, we're brain-based, right? And I know at one school it means they're teaching a class on the brain. At another school, they're doing movement and what they would call brain games. But what does this mean? Every school can't possibly be brain-based. What does that mean?
Well, everybody has a brain.
Okay, so every school is brain-based in that they're trying to get people to use their brains.
And let me add to that. What is the state of brain-based education, but also why do people gobble it up? Why do they love brain-based as opposed to like mind-based? Do you know
I think that brain-based is kind of sexy. It's this notion that, oh, there's this huge, vast army of scientists that are figuring all these wonderful things out and making these breathtaking discoveries, and we're advancing human knowledge. And it's been one of the big success explosion growth industries in the whole, you know, apparatus of science is we're understanding everything about the genome. We're understanding everything about the brain. To connect that mojo and excitement to what are my kids doing in third grade is an incredibly attractive proposition, and it's completely unregulated. There is no board of brain scientists who have approved any one of these single claims about brain-based education. There exists no such body. We haven't caught up in terms of like creating groups that can do such things.
This is great news. Denise, from now on, everything I say is brain-based.
Right. It means nothing. But is there any harm that can be done? I mean, should we be worried? As a parent, should I be worried that my kids are going to a school that's calling itself a brain-based school? I mean, should I be scared?
There's some research suggesting that the way you approach a learning task can have a huge impact on how learning unfolds. If you approach a learning task that, some children have incredible talents at math and some have incredible talents at music and never the twain shall meet, it may really impact how each one of those children learn math and music. And these kind of fixed attitudes sometimes go hand in hand with people's thoughts about the brain. On the flip side, we know that brains are incredibly plastic and brains change as you learn things. And so the way in which we sort of think about learning and connecting it to brain science, has a lot of potential as well as a lot of potential danger to it.
So a lot of people come to me and they say, well, I'm a visual learner, right? And generally, so they have a learning styles thought there. And I generally think, no, you're not a visual learner. You just don't like to read, right? But if someone claims they're a visual learner, could I go in and scan and find out, are they really a visual learner? Like whatever they're doing, their visual cortex is more active than somebody else's visual cortex?
So at the level of just cognitive research where people have looked for, you know, really solid evidence that, you know, people's professed learning preferences translate into differences in how they actually learn has come up incredibly shorthanded. It's a strong belief. Teachers have this great insight that kids have durative preferences in how they process information, what they like and what they don't like. And there's a great insight there. But the cognitive research has really come up empty-handed when it really comes to saying, okay, is there empirical evidence that learning is really going to be different based on, you know, what the learning preference is? I think the neuroscience gives us a new way of coming into this space and asking new questions about it. I think at first blush, it's going to largely confirm the empty-handed result that we get from cognitive science. But on the flip side, it might give us new insight into why do these people have these durative preferences? And so it's a new sort of playground to explore these ideas kind of with a fresh mind and a fresh vantage point.
So it's probably going to be cut up differently. It won't be I'm a visual thinker. It'll be I'm an interparietal sulcus thinker. Right, some very specific right. brain region.
Or if you give people the advantage to spontaneously, in a complex information environment, focus on what you prefer, we might see that we see hand in hand that these people, when watching a lecture, are tuning in to either visual or auditory or tactile opportunities to devote their own attention. And this is maybe one of the upshots of using a neuroscientific approach instead of just a directed behavioral assay approach. We can look at people's spontaneous preferences. When you watch a movie, when you listen to a story, when you're a child and you're watching Sesame Street, the way you volitionally just focus your attention during this learning experience or this visual experience are things that we can monitor using brain science. And we can actually see, oh, the way a kid devotes their attention during Sesame Street, during the number parts, is highly predictive of how well they score on a standardized math test.
Well, I know I learned a lot today, and I'm excited to hear that there is a little something out there to the brain-based education, but don't get too excited because it's a wide-open sort of wild, wild west.
So I think I want Bruce to have the last word. So what's the one thing you want parents to know about brain science?
The children's brains are incredibly plastic, and the learning experiences that you're imparting to your children and the selections that you make in schools can have a sculpting and shaping effect on who they become as an intellectual being.
All right. Thank you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're on the campus of Stanford University and on Sirius XM Insight 121.